for tuning in to the Illuminations podcast. We love having you here. It is our mission to be a beacon of light on your journey towards conscious and mindful living. In our weekly episode, we bring you inspiring change makers in the field of spirituality, healing, personal growth, and wellness who share their insight and expertise so you can navigate your way to a happier, healthier, and more purposeful life.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Illuminations World Podcast. I'm your host, Nia. I'm a clinical hypnotherapist, sound therapist, and yoga teacher. And we are back with you with another episode with another guest. So let me just first start off with the topic of today. It's such a great topic, and I can't wait to just dive right in because the topic is all about how can we apply the wisdom of ancient yogis in modern day life? Much needed. So to talk to us about this topic, I have a very special guest with me. His name is the very dear Anjan. Anjan is a meditation guide, relaxation coach, healer, and tantra mentor who specializes in helping people recognize relaxation to feel content, calm, and elevated in all forms of wellness. He uses ancient principles from wisdom traditions like yoga, tantra, and Zen to solve modern day problems. Thank you so much for being with me here today, Anjan. It's such a pleasure to have you. Hope you're well.
Namaste, Nia.
Namaste, namaste.
Thank you to you and to Illuminations for giving me another vehicle to share this beautiful world of ancient wisdom. I have a request. Shall we start with a small Om chanting?
Let's do that.
What Om does is it puts you in a state of alignment. And because the sound is so beautiful, it also physically, now science is talking about neuroplasticity and genome plasticity, it aligns your neurons. It amplifies and energizes the water. And in a scientific way, it even kind of aligns your genetic code to be able to conducive to listen to everything we're sharing so that you have focus and attention and it will give you tremendous value.
Let's do it.
So as we chant Om, we split it into R, O, and silence. Let's inhale. If you're driving, don't do this. Otherwise, you can join us. Inhale. And exhale with Om.
Thank you for that. So Anjan.
Sets the pace, right?
It does.
Sets the tone.
It really does. It really, really does. So I appreciate you for that.
In Sanskrit, this sound is called pranava.
Pranava.
The first sound, the primordial sound. When scientists today talk about the Big Bang, this is perhaps what they meant. And if you see across cultures and religions, they all talk, first there was the sound.
Yeah.
Whether it's Abrahamic religions and faiths, or whether it's Eastern traditions, the sound is always placed importance because the ancients really realized that sound is frequency. And if you can truly learn to access frequencies that align with the frequency of your own system and the frequency of the universe, that is what causes homeostasis and equilibrium.
And that's essentially what everyone's really looking for,
that's
right?
That's all we need.
Like trying to regulate back to homeostasis. And especially when we're talking about this particular sound and the way you chanted this.
Breaking down the four syllables.
Yeah, it's A, U, and M.
And then silence.
And then silence.
It's four syllables.
Wow, interesting.
Actually, there's five, but the fifth is space. So you don't really pay attention to it because the space exists in between the four.
And correct me if I'm wrong. So when you chant it in that way, you feel the vibrations in different parts of your body. Is that correct?
Every human has different experience. So I'm always a fan of bio-individuality.
Okay.
There's some schools, wisdom traditions that say you feel it from the top to the bottom. Some schools would say the exact opposite. Some people feel it just around their heart center, around their chest, around their rib cage. Some people don't feel it. But whether you feel it or not, whether you're sensitive to energy or not, it's irrelevant. Because as you chant it, automatically the sound creates a ripple effect of vibrations in you There's no necessity for belief. So it's a practice even for skeptics.
Got you. So let's just start off with your journey. Who are you? What do you do? And what, actually more than that, how did you end up walking this path? And why is it relevant to break it down for modern day living?
Beautiful question. As yogis, we don't hold on any importance to identities. So who are you is difficult for me to answer.
Okay.
But for the purpose of this podcast, I will find some identity to hold on to. Yeah, I identify myself in this avatar as somebody who is passionate about sharing ancient wisdom traditions to help solve modern day problems, like you introduced me. How we do this is to create the practical aspect of these ancient wisdom traditions. For example, there is a concept called Vairagya. Vairagya is a 5,000-year-old concept, which the yogis practice. Vairagya in general translates to compassionate detachment or detached attachment or inert attachment. How can you translate that to your practical, physical, urban life is that there are three levels of attachment we all have.
Mm.
The first level is to materialistic things, things like our phone, our car, our keys. I'm assuming many people listening to this podcast are already having a detached attachment with that level. Say you lose your phone or your car keys or you dent your car or you tear a shirt, you're okay. You'll get another one.
Mm.
Many people are still not there. They really get traumatized
mm-hmm.
when they lose their phone or when their car keys or sunglasses or their Fendi Louis Vuitton bag. Okay, but the Illuminations listeners, I know, are beyond that. The second level is relationships. My father, my mother, my wife, my husband, my daughter, my son, my teacher, my student. You can have them in abundance, but recognize that you don't own them.
Mm.
Because this ownership causes worry, tension, distress, because then you have expectations of their behavior. So this is practical way to practice Vairagya, compassionate attachment. And the last and the most important is ideas, perspectives, thoughts, opinions. As yogis, we are trained to question everything, which also means we're attached to very little, or we have compassionate detachment, Vairagya, to most of these things. If you can practice Vairagya with your identity, with your concepts that you have, with your the stories that you tell yourself, with your ideas and perspectives, you become more open-minded. You become really able to receive alternative perspectives. And then if you recognize that 99% of the conflict in the world, whether it's wars or racism or classism, exists because
of identity.
Somebody's holding on to their identity too strong, right? I am white, you're black, so I kill you. I'm Indian, you're Pakistani, so I fight with you. I'm Russian, you're Ukrainian, so I attack you. I'm American, you're Mexican, so we put a border and a big wall.
This Any is other. My wife. She is your wife and you hurt her.
Exactly. Oh, that's a whole different topic.
The Will Smith and Chris Rock.
Monogamy is one of these Pandora's boxes you don't want to get me started on, but I will talk about that later, maybe another edition. Deconstructing monogamy and polyamory and what it really is, what functional relationship is. But getting back to Vairagya, the minute you can have this compassionate detachment, you automatically are growing and expanding, which is the essence of all wisdom traditions. They want you to grow and expand. So who I am is somebody who deconstructs these ancient concepts to be able to practically apply it in a day-to-day urban scenario, because we live in a big city like Dubai or London or New York or Berlin or wherever you're tuning in from.
But for you to even want to do that, what was your experience like? So therefore, you, I'm sure you probably had to go through a ton of training or knowledge and so on. But why is it important for you to want to do that?
So I only answered the first part of your question, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was, what do I do for work?
Yeah.
When you can transcend from seeing what you do as work, that's a state of ananda or blissfulness. Through training, you're able to construct your life in such a way you're only doing what you love, whereas you don't see it as work. Work is a word used when you have to motivate yourself to go do something.
But not necessarily work can be...
Not necessarily, of course. Words can be played around with. But in general, when people say work, it means something that... You have to motivate yourself. If it gives you joy, it transcends work and it becomes life. Like this podcast for you is not work mm-hmm. because you're just enjoying every moment of it. So when you can transcend that, and a practical way to do that is if you go to office 5 days a week and you wait for the weekends, flip your perspective, get a paradigm shift, right? Think of yourself as living your life 7 days a week, taking a break for 5 days a week at office. But you're living your life, and weekend is a day you live your life. Then you won't have any weekends. You'll only have strong ends.
I love that.
I told you, yogis love puns. So I don't see anything I do as work. My mission and my passion is to help serve humanity to understand themselves better, to recognize how they can add value to themselves and to humanity. And my path is deconstructing ancient concepts for modern day application, because I live in a city and all my clients live in a city.
Right.
When I lived in Bali, and I lived in Thailand, when I lived in Himalayas, when I lived in Goa, I figured people there are already uber relaxed. They already have a tremendous sense of peace and calm, maybe because of the nature, maybe because of the vibe, maybe because of the lifestyle, the food, the water, and the general ethos of the these cities that I spoke about. But in a big city like Dubai or London or New York or Bombay or Berlin, wherever you're tuning in from, of course, you have the tensions of living in a city.
Yeah.
And this is where my work comes in. So that I dedicated myself to people who live in a city. I could be living in Bali, really chilled out, but I said I'm not helping as many people as I could help if I could be based in a city. And which is why a brand like Illuminations is in a big city like Dubai, because people here, because of the capitalistic, consumeristic drive and the productivity indoctrination, need holistic wellness, well-being services.
100%. And I completely agree with you. And I totally love what you just said. But now my question is...
I haven't answered the third part of your question. You gave me three questions in the beginning.
So the third one was your journey.
Yes. So I call it brown privilege.
Brown privilege.
That's right. I was born into a family of yogis and practitioners of Tantra. And I was brought up reading the Vedas and the Upanishads and ancient Indian texts, attending kirtans and bhajans and mantra sessions, practicing asana, which means posture, yoga postures, and numerology, astrology, Ayurveda, homeopathy, mantras, yantras,
tantras. So this was very much ingrained into your childhood, you would say?
As a child, of course, I was rebelling. And I was like, I don't want to go to grandpa's class. I just want to play.
Yeah.
My grandfather was a student of Krishnamacharya.
Oh, wow.
And I considered him my main guru, classmate of BKS Iyengar, ordained Zen monk, homeopath, Ayurveda, Zen master, Reiki grandmaster, a bunch of other things. Also, Tantra lineage. He was a lineage holder for a few Tantra lineages. So I think when I was a kid and a teenager, I was like, this is not for me. And I was just playing, and you know how kids are. But I think around when I was 16, 17, 18, I realized the treasure house I was living with. And then I went back saying, hey, can you tell me this? But I also know that as a child, because I was, say, forced, I saw it then as forced. Now I'm saying, thank you for forcing me, right? These things just get absorbed subconsciously, I guess, as a hypnotherapist, you know this. And these were patterns that later I'm recognizing now, oh, this is why I know this.
Yeah.
Somebody would be chanting some mantra and I know the entire thing by heart, though I've never studied it. It's because when I was a child, I was exposed to all of this. I don't have a particular enlightenment moment, which is a great story. And I know many teachers and gurus and spiritual people, they have like, at this moment, my life changed. I don't have one of those. It's been a gradual path of transformation. I still say I'm a beginner. I just began before other people.
Yeah.
And because of this brown privilege, the family that was rooted in the Vedic culture, like many Indian families, then when I was 2016, now you know my age, something happened, a physical reaction happened, and I didn't know what it was. Only a few years later, my grandfather revealed to me that it was a kundalini sensitivity that had happened. So then he said, come. I said, okay. He said, I'm going to tell you things to do, do it. So for 10 years, and I didn't know it was 10 years till 2016. Sorry, this was 2006. Sorry. Till 2016, I didn't know it was 10 years. In 2016, he came to me and said, okay, I've given you everything you need. Go. So what do you mean? So yeah, we finished 10 years. And I'm like, wow, the old man had a plan. And I didn't even know till then. So 2006 to 2016 was my intensive 10-year study with my teacher, where he really put me through a lot of different practices, a lot of initiations, a lot of rituals. And he sent me to other teachers to get certified and get qualified and get initiated. So this has been my journey. My journey with physical body work started in 2002 when I lived in Thailand. I learned Thai yoga massage. And then I started learning Japanese martial arts. I got my black belt in 2010. I got my instructor's license in 2014. This made me very attracted to Japan. And because my grandfather was also a Japanese monk, I spent every year I'd visit the monasteries there. We'd spend a month there at the monastery near Kyoto. And I learned both Soto and Rinzai style. Zazen, Shikantaza, which is the way of seated meditation, Zen, and Kinhin, which is walking meditation. So I got, let's say, they gave me the rank Dashi, which means the one who's allowed to show the path. It's like, I think, five ranks before Osho. So since then, I've been sharing even principles from Zen. And of course, Tantra lineages, I was sent to many different teachers. And post-2016, I discovered my own teachers. So I've been initiated in a few different lineages of Tantra. And I'm also now an ardent student of what is called California Tantra or New Age Neo Tantra. Classical Tantra was what I got trained in, but now I'm also exploring New Age Tantra. So this is my journey so far. I've just begun.
So what exactly is Tantra? Because there's like a lot
direct
of
direct to the point.
There's a lot of misconceptions about Tantra being like that people think it's all just about sex, but I'm sure it isn't. So can you just tell us about Tantra?
Tanoti iti trayate Tantra. Tanoti, liberation, trayate, expansion. The ability to find expansion through your sensory perception is Tantra. Let's imagine you're somewhere 5,000 years ago in the Vedic ages. The yogis are rebelling because there's too many rules being put on them saying you need to be a Puritan, you need to not eat meat, you need to not be a householder, you can't have sexual relationships, you cannot have children, you need to renounce and become a priest if you really want to understand liberation. This is where you are. What happens? The yogis by nature are rebels. They say, I don't like your establishment, I don't like your rituals, I'm going to rebel. That's how Tantra was born, as a rebel to rituals and ritualistic practices. Though Tantra has its own rebels. But I think through the centuries, both have intermingled, and today there's really not much of a difference between yoga and Tantra. All yoga is designed on Tantra. Expansion through physical sensations, right? So all yoga asana is Tantra.
Yeah, because it's a tool in some
way. That's right. The essence of Tantra, another way of looking at Tantra is Tana means the body-mind construct. Tan, even today in Hindi, they use the word tan, mandhan, tan, right? Tra, again, is expansion, trayati. Another way to look at it is that the body and the three, tra can also be traya, three, the three ways of expansion. So any expansion you can have through your physical sensations and beyond your physical sensations is tantra. How does that apply in a practical level when you're drinking a cup of water? If you can be completely involved in the drinking water to the extent that maybe your mouth is making love to the water. This is Tantra. When you're walking in the grass, your feet are making love to the grass. When you're swimming in the ocean, your body's making love to the ocean. So Tantra is this constant element of making love. Of course, the West considers it only to be with the genitals, but this is wrong. I can make love even with my fingertip, not necessarily to another human. I can make love to my own divine inner being.
Would you call that involvement and presence?
To begin with, yes, mindfulness, involvement, presence. But as you go deeper, it's like a dancer merging with a dance is Tantra. A painter merging with his art. He's involved, of course. He's present, of course. He's mindful. But eventually, there's no difference between the dancer and the dance. They merge. The musician merges with his music. This merging happens through Tantra to find yoga, which is the oneness.
Wow, that's so beautifully said. That's incredible.
I try to simplify.
I love that. I really, really love that. So tell us a little bit. So now you spoke about Tantra. So where does yoga, so you mentioned yoga is essentially Tantra, but can you just debunk the myths that comes in terms of yoga and Tantra?
There are a lot of yoga myths. So let's debunk some yoga myths first. First of all, when we use the word yoga today, unfortunately in the West, it's considered to be just
asana practice.
Just physical exercise or sports yoga. And nothing wrong with that. It's great to have flexibility and be able to bend and make pretzel shapes, but that's far away from what yoga is, right? Yeah. So that's the first myth I need to break. Second myth is that yoga is always for positivity. Yoga never says be positive. Yoga says be sober. Sobriety is the key. So positivity, negativity is only human construct. Yeah. You know, my Zen master used to tell me, the mountain never says it's a tall mountain. only we say tall mountain short.
I love that.
This relativity is a human construct. It's a story. If the story is helping you, why not have that story, right? In yoga, the only morality is it helping you grow? Is it making you decay? This is the only morality or polarity. Either ways, this is the only ends we look
helping
at.
Helping you grow
or making you decay.
But isn't there learning in everything? So even by saying learning or decay, that in itself is some form of judgment,
I'm talking about activity. Any activity, any thought, any feeling you have, it helping? I'm saying good and bad, like yoga is good, yoga is bad. We'll get back to judgment. I like that one. Mm-hmm. So that's the second myth. Third myth is, I need certain branded pants. I need a mat. I need a yoga studio. You don't need any of this. Yoga is the most beautiful thing in the world. You can sit down. It's for free. You can do it anytime. You can do it anywhere. And you can do it on your own. And this is the beauty of the science of yoga. It's beyond nationality, color, religion, race, caste. Only in the last, India is only 50 years old and India is claiming ownership over yoga. It's the most silly thing. Mm. Yoga existed way before India existed. Mm. Yoga existed way before the Indian subcontinent was called the Indian subcontinent. Mm. Yoga is a way of life. It's a science of how you can live your life in complete unison with yourself. And when I say yourself, you can call that yourself anything. You can call it divinity. You can call it super consciousness. You can call it Allah, Jesus, Shiva, Buddha. You can call it cosmic consciousness. Whatever you want to call it, whatever floats your boat. You can, whatever tickles your pickle. But at the end of the day, it's this union and a constant recognition that you are beyond what you think you are. Mm. And that ability to create that distance and thereby bring the union. It seems paradoxical. The distance is between all the stories you have and who you are. And thereby, you get union with who you are. Kind of like, in simple words to say, creating a distance between the observed and the observer.
So how do you...
a distance between the experience and the experiencer, between the witnessed and the witnesser.
So how do you cultivate that in our everyday lives, right? Like this sounds great in terms of context, but when it comes to everyday life, when we're...
Simple steps, right? So Patanjali, who's a great yogi, wrote a beautiful book called Yoga Sutras, mm-hmm. where he's identified 8-step process to cultivate what he calls kaivalya or complete merging. You don't need to recreate it. I mean, so many people are recreating and reforming their own steps, but just go back to this fantastic 3,000-year-old book. And if you don't like that, there's Hatha Yoga Pradipika, there's all the Vedas, there's all the Anushtanas, there's the Jataka tales, there's Upanishad, there's so much. So I don't want to reinvent anything. So we'll go with Patanjali's form of Yoga Sutras. Yeah. So in his Yoga Sutra, he says, the first line he says is, now yoga shall begin, which means what? Which means you need to be in a certain state of mind. You need to have your life sorted. You need to have peace and calm already before you start yoga.
Interesting.
It's not meditation gives you relaxation. Only if you're relaxed will you find the meditative state. Similarly, I can't go to a poor person who doesn't have any money for his meal and say, let's meditate, let's do yoga asana, right? It's the most impractical thing.
Yeah.
So in the Vedas, they talk about dharma, artha, kama, moksha, the purushartha. Have you heard of this?
No.
So it's similar. I mean, it's been borrowed in the Japanese and they call it ikigai. So dharma.
Okay.
I will say it in very brief to... and then get back to your question. Dharma is basically, what are you designed to do? Mm. So I always tell
your duty.
People, not just your duty, what are you designed to do? For example, an elephant can't climb a tree, a monkey can't fly, and a bird can't swim, right? Or a fish can't climb a tree. So you're designed to do something. And if you end up putting everybody in the same box and say, you got to do this, this is your duty, of course they're going to fail. So dharma is this inner understanding of what are you designed to do?
Right.
What do you like? What are you good at? What is your duty? What can you do effortlessly? Like for you, hosting a podcast is so effortless. So this is one of your dharmas. So the study of your own dharma is called swadharma, ancient Sanskrit concept. And everybody needs to find time to introspect before you start yoga or meditation. Say, what really do I want to do? Second step, artha. Artha generally means the meaning. Or the support around what you want to do. So you need financial support, you need resources, you need human support, you need connections. So how can you build this connection? That's artha, kama, desire. What do you really desire to do? How do you desire to change the world? How do you desire to change yourself? How do you desire to add value?
Mm.
And finally, moksha. Even you have these 3 steps, you get liberation from the confusion that exists in all humans till they go through these steps. And once you finish this confusion, then you start yoga. And in yoga, there's some, in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, he's clearly listed out very great points like saucha, cleanliness, which means decluttering your mind, satya, speaking the truth, ahimsa, being non-violent. And he's explained in niyamas and yamas, the rules of how you can interact with yourself and how you can interact with somebody else. It's a whole different podcast if you're going to get into the Yoga Sutras, but you can really read fantastic translations and interpretations of the Yoga Sutras. Find one, read it. It's a great book. And then he goes to dharana. Before that, there's asana pranayama. So yamas, niyamas, asana pranayama, asana posture, which means the ability to have a stability in whatever you're doing. So asana simply means if I'm here with Nia in this podcast, I have nowhere else to be.
Mm.
And therefore, I'm here 100%. This is my asana.
Mm.
It means I have nowhere else to be now. If I had somewhere else to be, I'd be thinking of, oh, what am I going to eat next? Oh, I have this next meeting. And being present automatically comes when you practice asana. So asana is beyond posture. It's going within through the posture. And then there's pranayama. Pranayama is roughly translated as breath work, but it's not. There's no work involved because breath is something you don't need to work for.
Mm. Right?
Pranayama is simply consciously moving your breath within you. And that starts with breath awareness. When you start with breath awareness, automatically 80% of your problems are gone because your breath starts reaching every single cell in your body, every single atom in your body, and it's healing it through breath.
Mm.
And then you go to dharana, which is a form of introspection. It's also a form of inner, let's say, looking within. And then you go to dhyana, which is roughly translated as meditation or focused awareness or expanded focused awareness. And then from there, you go to samadhi and kaivalya. So it's a beautiful book. Read it. Step by step, he's explained very nicely on how you can reach this union. And very practical, because today you need to do this in your conference room, at a sales meeting, at the traffic jam. This is where you need to use these principles. So if you can start with self-regulation, and if you can start with purpose, your purushartha, if you can start with what am I good at, what can I do, and if you can start with that, then nothing can stop you because everything is from within.
So just for my understanding as well as everyone else's, so before you even start yoga, you need to think about where you are, basically delete all the noise.
There's no hard and fast rule. The recommended way is this.
Mm.
Of course, some people might say you're climbing a mountain, you might go up a path and realize that's not the one. You might come down and want to climb from another side because it's a more circular path.
Yeah.
So it's the same. Maybe you took a shortcut. It's okay.
Mm.
It's bio-individuality. The recommended path is this. But some people just reach Kaivalya without any of this. Some people reach Samadhi without any of this. Some people have genetically great bones and powerful muscles, so they're able to reach Asana Siddhi without any of this. Some people have fantastic breath awareness without any of this. So it's bio-individuality.
Gotcha.
Which is where it's important for you to do the self-work, to figure out what works for you and do that.
Right, right.
There's no right or wrong in yoga, as I told you. There's only, does it help you grow? Is it making you decay?
I love that. And how, so I want you to give us some insight. Okay, let's take a common problem these days, like stress and anxiety or depression. Can you give us an insight, let's say, if someone's struggling with issues like that?
Okay.
How do you go about that?
If somebody is struggling with all these issues,
yeah,
it would be the silliest thing to go and ask them to meditate. Okay?
100%.
Because they're like, get out of here. I can't. So, first of all, I think as society and as therapists, we need to start helping people realize that they are not their problem. So when somebody comes to me, one of my clients comes to me and says, I am anxious, I am angry. Already they're accepting that identity as them.
Mm.
So if they can transcend, this is the first job of any therapist, if they can transcend from I am angry to I am feeling anger.
Yeah.
From I am anxious to I am feeling anxiety. Automatically you do the first thing I said, create that distance. And the minute you can create that distance, healing automatically starts to happen because they're no longer seeing it as a struggle. They're no longer seeing it as an identity. Of course, they're not going to get rid of that anxiety because it's a natural state. Then you start to observe. Anxiety comes, and any worry and stress and duress. And I'm not talking about trauma, okay? Trauma is a very specific definition in all the scientific journals, which is either sexual trauma or war trauma, or you saw somebody dying in your arms or PTSD. It's very specific. I'm not talking about trauma. I mean, trauma trend is something that's so popular on Instagram today. And I've seen some really silly posts, even on TikTok. Oh, I got bitten by a mosquito. I have trauma. It's not trauma. Remember, if you're using the word trauma, you're taking away the faculty from people who really have trauma. So stop using this word. Mm-hmm. Instead, distress, pain, tension, worry, anxiety, all this is fine. We need to recognize that all of this comes from only two places. One, from things that happened in the past.
Yeah.
Two, things that will happen in the future. And if you can start to slowly eliminate the attention you're paying to the past and the future and start paying attention to the here and now, which is what I said, you sort your life. I have nowhere else to be other than here with Nia. Right? Yeah. So I'm not worried about the past where I was. I'm not worried about the future where I was. So I'm able to self-regulate. Swadharma, self-regulate. And swadhyaya, self-study. Swadhyaya, that's a correct pronunciation. Self-study on how I am completely in this moment and here. Because where else can you be? So as therapists, if you can help people to recognize that their past is dead and their future is unborn, they have nowhere else to be other than here.
Mm.
And throughout the systems, whether it's yoga or Zen or martial arts or tantra, there's so many tools and techniques to help you bring yourself to the moment, which includes conscious breathing, which includes mantras, which includes visualization, which includes energy healing, which includes hypnotherapy, mm-hmm. which includes a multitude of modalities. You choose one that works for you and practice that.
Mm.
Encourage your bio-individuality. You choose one that works for you. Maybe listening to some beautiful mantras works for you. Maybe sitting down and just watching your thoughts works for you, which is called self-inquiry. Maybe listening to a guided meditation works for you. Maybe boxing works for you. Maybe running works for you. Maybe swimming works for you. Maybe extreme sports work. Find what works for you to help you to be in the moment. Maybe watching the sunset works for you. And when you can find that activity that helps you be in the moment, you will automatically drop into the natural state of silence, which need not be taught, which need not be guided. It's your natural state of silence. When you drop into that, you slowly start to destroy things that cause you worry, tension, trouble. At a more practical level, you need to recognize that anything that causes you worry, tension, trouble is within you. So this might be a hard truth for many people who are saying, no, he spoke in some way and so I'm worried. She behaved like this, so that caused me anger. This situation happened, so I'm tensed. But remember that the reaction is from within.
Mm-hmm.
So stop the blame game. Get serious. Stop encouraging the drama. If you really want to heal, you can. The power is within you. And I'm not just saying it. Many people just say it. And it's the truth. That's why many people say it, right? But remember that you placing the blame on an external circumstance or person or event is you encouraging that. Instead, take the onus, take the responsibility and recognize that your reaction to that situation, person or event is from within you. And this is the biggest truth.
I love that. The last point about taking accountability, which is the hardest thing to do, I believe, because it's a lot easier to blame someone else or point fingers and then play the victim than to say, hey, I have a choice. Or
I think it's hard or easy, right? If you say it's hard, it's hard. If you say it's easy, it's easy. But I think it's convenient. Because
okay,
you don't
convenient
have to do
will
self,
be a better word.
You don't
yeah.
have to do self-work.
Mm.
In fact, it's easy to say, I'm in charge of my inner emotions. But it's actually harder to be a victim if you actually think about it in hard and easy way. But that's irrelevant because as long as you can realize that you're not a TV, take back your remote control.
I love that. So let's just go through those steps. So first you said to transcend the identity. So like form that separation between the observer and what you're feeling. And
there's no first in that. This is it. This can begin, this can end. At the end of the day, if you can create that distance between the one experiencing and the one and the experience,
yeah.
that's it. You can start there and you'll finish there itself. But if you haven't started there, eventually I hope you reach there.
Yeah.
Because what else is there?
Absolutely. So, but when it comes to the path of healing, that will be a great place to start in terms of cultivating that practice, correct?
In my perspective, I don't see the necessity for prolonging. I know many people say, oh, you have to reach there. Oh, it's a lofty goal. Oh, it's so far away. It's a great thing. That's all you need to transform. So you are capable of transformation in that moment. And you're capable of transformation right now. So don't delay it. Don't see it as a hefty, you know, ideal. Don't put it on a big pedestal and say, I got to reach there someday. Of course, healing is continuous. Mm. Nobody is completely healed.
Yeah.
The journey is continuous. The path will go on. But your ability to to today, at this moment, decide, I'm not going to encourage the drama. I'm going to make a conscious choice to choose my well-being. This is right now. So today can be either one day or it can be day one.
Wow. So it all literally comes down to a choice.
Conscious choice. Absolutely.
And you taking full onus to your life and the way you feel and the experiences you have.
Absolutely.
So I really, we said we'll come back to a specific concept called judgment. Mm. So I really want to talk a little bit about that, and I want to hear what you want to share about that.
So I got the feeling that you were telling me judgment is bad.
No.
What you said. No?
No. I wasn't saying judgment is bad. Mm. From my perspective, I feel like judgment is a very interest, especially as a therapist with the work that I do, I can see how a lot of the distress comes down to judgment, individual mind maps, okay, which is coming from how they perceive the experience. And this is very much in tied with separating the observer and the experience.
So we're aligned on this because everything is judgment.
Exactly.
Therefore, yoga says, don't have this duality. This philosophy in the Vedas is also called Advaita, which is propounded in the Vedanta, Anta and Veda Vedas. So Vedanta has this philosophy called Advaita, non-duality.
Mm.
And non-duality philosophy is basically telling you that there is no dichotomy between the experience and the experiencer. Or there's no dichotomy between you and your divinity. Mm. So break this dichotomy and break this duality. There is no dichotomy between, like Tantra says, there's no mind and body. It's the mind-body-spirit construct. Mm. It's one word for it, Tana.
Mm.
So judgment is constantly prevalent. How did I decide I'm going to spend time with you today and not somebody else? It was a judgment. Mm. When you're eating something, how do you decide you want that dish and not something else? It's a judgment. When you buy a shirt, how do you decide this is a shirt you want and not another shirt? Judgment is great because it gives you the power of discernment.
Mm.
Now, of course, you have to find ways that the judgment you make is giving you growth and not making you decay. Because if you choose through your judgment, like you said, some of them choose, they judge it and then they choose something that causes you decay. Of course, it's going to cause you decay. It's your own judgment.
I love what you just said, because knowing that your judgment will have its consequences or have a particular set of actions, and you being ready for those actions rather than falling victim to it and so on. So no matter what you do, there will be certain
absolutely
positives, negatives, actions. Let's call it just consequences, but it comes down to you being ready for those consequences rather than looking at what is the right thing to do, what's the wrong thing to do. Is that correct?
In the Bhagavad Gita, there's a concept of karma phala. The Bhagavad Gita is a great ancient Indian text where Lord Shri Krishna explains to Arjuna how he should go and kill his relatives in the battlefield. You've heard of the Bhagavad Gita. So the concept of karma phala. Karma means action. Phala means fruit. Every action has a fruit. Mm. Now to understand this clearly, I want you to understand that if you plant a mango seed, it will only become a mango tree.
Yeah.
That's a judgment. Do you want mango tree or pineapple tree? Right? But the minute you plant a mango seed and expect coconuts out of it, that is when you're getting ready for distress.
Yeah.
But just because you plant a mango seed, there's no guarantee it'll become a full-fledged tree, because a little cat might dig out the sapling, a little goat might eat the small shrub, a woodcutter might cut the tree, I don't know, a thunderstorm might break the entire mangrove. There's no guarantee.
Mm.
Your job is to plant the seed, water, put the fertilizer, protect it from the little cat and the cow, make sure the woodcutter doesn't cut it, grow other mangoes so the soil erosion doesn't happen. This is your job.
Yeah.
You cannot expect the mango fruit, tasty mango fruit. Again, then what do you get? You get maybe Alfonso, maybe you get Totapuri, maybe you get some other mango, maybe it's not the mango you wanted. But the mango seed will only become mango fruit. It will never become coconut. So if you can put these two concepts in your head very clearly, that every action you have will have a definite consequence. But at the same time, there's no guarantee of that consequence.
Mm.
This is the karma phala concept.
Got
practically
it.
Explained. So let go of your expectations of the result. At the same time, know that if the result is something that you want, that'll help you grow, then do it. But if it's something that'll make you decay, then don't do it. Very simple, no? Why do we complicate it?
And I love what you just introduced a topic called expectations, because that's also a very important thing I feel like we need to just touch base on. What is your advice for people who are listening who find it very hard to let go of expectations?
What I started with, Vairagya, have this detached attachment where your expectation will give you disappointment because nothing is in your control. Yeah. The only thing in your control is your inner state of how you respond or react. You can't control what happens in the world. Yeah. You can't even control your body.
Yeah.
You think you have the illusion of controlling your body, but what, 10%? If you're a yogi, 20%? Because all your internal processes, your digestion, your respiration, your circulation, your endocrinal system, you have no clue. The body doesn't trust you with that. So it does it on its own. Only with the breath, the body says, okay, I'll give you some amount of control once in a while when you're doing conscious breathing, conscious pranayama. Otherwise, I'm going to take care of even breath. So what do you really have control of?
Yeah.
Only how you react or respond to situations. Only how you think, what you think, how you feel, what you feel. This is completely and 100% in your control. So train to work on this inner game. Mm. Train to work on this dimension within you because that's the only thing you can control. So even if you have to take home only one thing from this entire episode today, it's that whatever happens in your life starts from within you. And whatever reaction you have, however you react or respond, however you think, however you feel, is from within you. And this is what all ancient wisdom traditions say. A practical way to constantly be in remembrance of that is gratitude.
Wow, why do you say that?
Kritagyata is the Sanskrit word for gratitude. When you drop down to gratitude, and the Sufis call it zikr, when you drop down to gratitude, you feel so thankful and feel so grateful for all the blessings you have. You stop looking at things that cause you worry and tension because you're just so happy. In the morning when you wake up, you are breathing. If you can just have gratitude at that moment. So many people didn't wake up today.
Yeah.
Right? So if you can just have this perspective of, hey, I'm just so thankful for being alive, for experiencing all of this, for having these troubles because it's teaching me something, for having this tension because it's making me stronger, for going through this breakup because it's helping me realize what I don't want in the relationship, for losing this job because it's paving bigger opportunities for me. Anything that you perceive as bad, push gratitude onto it and it'll help you sail through, and then your reaction automatically will not be a reaction, it'll be a response. So gratitude is the key there.
I love that. So we have Vairagya. We have gratitude.
Kritagyata.
Kritagyata. Is that?
Sanskrit.
Kritagyata.
Gratitude. So cute, you're taking notes.
Gyata. And finally, I want to ask you, what's your tip for people when it comes to meditation? Because a lot of people find it very hard to meditate. So
the important thing here is to bust some myths about meditation, right?
Let's do it.
So the word meditation itself is misleading because the word dhyana in Sanskrit has so much of depth. In fact, in the yogic system, we have dhyana, dharana, japa, tapa, mantra, yantra, so many ways to reach the meditative state. But to break it down very simply, there's only mainly three types. First is focused awareness, where you're completely focused on something. This can start with conscious breath awareness. It can start with rhythm awareness, which is watching any rhythm in your body, including your breath. This can start with self-awareness and self-inquiry, which we spoke about. This can start with pattern awareness, where you look at mandala or a yantra or the moon or an archetype, a god you like, or your mother's face or the sun or some kind of a design or some kind of a deity. Then it can happen with sound awareness, which is mantras and guided meditation or some beautiful tune or some music that makes you move. So any focused awareness, or it can also be things like trataka, which is eye-open meditation. There's many, many different techniques. So that's one. The second is expanded awareness.
Okay.
Tantra uses a lot of this, where you expand your sight, your sound, your touch, your taste, your smell, and you expand your awareness so much to really incorporate and engulf everything that happens around you, and your consciousness starts to expand and your ability. So they've got the hot air balloon meditation, they've got the white light visualization meditation, they've got the visualize you're the sun meditation. There's so many different techniques. The third is self-inquiry, what I spoke about before, creating the distance between the observed and the observer. To simplify meditation is that in any moment when you can drop into silence, that's meditation. This naturally happens for all humans. Just as yogis, we don't want to leave it to chance. We want to know how to hack and get it any moment we want. For example, let's imagine you're watching a beautiful sunset At that moment, because your eyes are closed now, as you're hearing my voice, you're able to feel the breeze of the wind on your face. Close your eyes if you haven't yet. You're able to see in your mind's eye the sky break out into a variety of colors, orange, yellow, purple, red, crimson, pink. You're able to hear the sound waves and feel the sea breeze on your face. You're able to feel a sense of lightness. At that moment, when you were watching that sunset, did you have any worries of your past? No. Did you have any anxiety of your future? No. Did you even remember your name or your nationality or creed or your job or your title or anything? Nothing. You were just simply there. Here and now was what the sunset made you do. So anybody who says, I have difficulty meditating, I say, when you're watching a sunset, you were meditating. You were reaching the state that we call meditation. So meditating is not something you do. You do many things to reach the state of meditation. There's no benefit from meditation. There's no gain. All the gains happen as a corollary, as an extra.
Yeah.
Meditation is your natural state. And when you react and respond and act naturally, there's nothing to do. And that's when you truly move from human doing to human beingness. This is the state of beingness. And anybody can reach this. I mean, people reach this when they, if there's any mothers tuned in, you've reached this when you saw your baby's face for the first time. If there's any artists, you reach the state when you either paint or you dance or you play a song or you play music. If there's any creators, you do this when you create. You do this when you get immersed in nature. This happens to you sometimes even when you listen to music. Sometimes this happens when you consume certain psychedelic substances. Everybody has experienced meditation. So anybody who say, I find it hard, you just got to show them that what their idea of meditation is not the same. And my advice is, if you think it's hard, it probably is. Recollect the moments in your life when you just drop down to silence effortlessly. Those are your meditative moments. And you've had them. So now learn how to hack it. Learn how to bring it anytime to you. Learn how to anytime, anywhere, drop down to silence.
I love that. Thank you so much for that. And it's so juicy. It's so insightful. And I could honestly speak to you for hours on this topic. But unfortunately, we have come to the end of our show. But before we part ways, any last words for our viewers and for our listeners?
Remember that there's two forces acting in you. And that's why the mandala of the heart dimension, we call it the Anahata chakra. Oh, that's a whole different topic. Can of worms there, chakras. Just quickly, you have 114 dimensions we call chakras, 112 accessible to the human experience, 108 that you can really get sensitive to. So don't believe everything you read, question everything. Don't really just feel there's only seven chakras. Each one has a color. Each one has a certain love only exists in my heart. No, when I feel love, I feel it in every single cell in my body. So how can love only exist in my heart chakra? When I feel intuitive, I feel it all over my body and especially my gut. So how can intuition only exist in the Ajna chakra? Don't believe anything till you have experienced it. So as I was talking about chakras and nadis and 72,000 nadis, I just want to leave you with the thought that there are two elements to your life. One is you are a human being occasionally having spiritual experiences.
Yeah.
But you're also a spiritual being having this human experience. So enjoy this human experience, because of course you want to do holistic and spiritual activities, meditation and yoga and Zen and Tantra. This is you expanding. But what about the spirit that wants to experience this humanness? So don't deny that spirit the pleasure. Whatever you want to call it, spirit, God, divinity, conscious, cosmic conscious, what doesn't matter, the name doesn't matter. Whatever you want to call it, wants to experience this human experience. So allow it to do it and be in awareness and question everything till you can understand it from within. Don't pay attention to the intellect. Drop down to the heart and recognize that your job is to spread love and light. For that, you need to first remember you are love and light. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hopefully see you all soon for our next episode. Until then, stay safe and live light.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love to have you tune in again next week as we discuss more engaging topics on relationships, health, career, self-care, and spirituality. If you'd like to help support this podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave us a rating and review. We'd be extremely grateful. To catch all the latest from us, you can also follow us on Instagram at Illuminations World or visit the Illuminations World YouTube channel for more inspiring content. See you again next week, and until then, live light.